The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
To begin with, I'm going to let you know that Larry's going to be handing out some resource guides that I think might be pretty useful to you. There's some really, I think, really interesting things in there. Also, I really hope that you take care of yourself during this meeting. If you feel like you need to get up, walk around, lay down, please feel free to do so. Also, there's going to be some healthy snacks circulating, because I know this is early in the morning. And also stay hydrated. You know, once you're a paramedic, you just can't stop. So with that, I want to welcome every single one of you to this meeting. The book that inspired this talk is called No More Stairs. I added the word stairs, and it's a homonym for stairs as walking, and that is a way to literally shut people out, not let people in. And then psychological barriers, as in staring, that you're being literally glared at or that you are being stared at. So until this book was written, for the most part, the only positive stories that we would hear about folks were President Roosevelt, who had polio, or Helen Keller, who was deaf and blind and later became a socialist in her adulthood. Now, in the handout, you'll see some references to this book. So the girls and women in this book are not famous, but I have to say that their story is just as dramatic and just as inspirational. And No More Stairs is a mosaic of racial minorities, lesbians, students, artists, mothers, and so much more. What the book did do was lead me to this really fascinating, inspirational, and really exciting piece of history from below. It's a story of mass collective struggle fought and won by ordinary people with disabilities and their supporters. What started out as a little demonstration 41 years ago in 1977 became a 26-day sit-in and occupation of a federal building in San Francisco. It's called the 504 sit-in. We're going to get to the origins of the name of the 504 sit-in in a minute. So this sit-in was led by blind people, deaf people, people who use wheelchairs, disabled veterans, people with mental health disabilities, people with intellectual developmental disabilities, and people with substance use disorders. So the 504 sit-in and occupation, and later the American with Disabilities Act, inspired activism by people with disabilities that won reforms, legal rights, and profoundly changed the lives for millions of people around the globe. The 504 sit-in is also a story about cross-fertilization between the disabled movement and other social movements of the time. Many of the participants didn't even consider themselves activists in any sense of the word. Others were seasoned activists who learned how to organize in anti-war movement, black civil rights, women's liberation, gay liberation, and militant trade unionism. Other participants and leaders brought socialist ideas, strategy, and tactics, which proved key to winning. It's a story of how the disabled movement was able to build unity with diverse forces that gave disabled activists not only to disrupt, but to win. So, and this is by using direct action. So everyone, from first-time protesters to activists, socialists, together changed lives, changed the world, and basically kicked ass. So like many of the people in this room, a lot of the occupiers were young. And in some ways, I believe that the occupation's success was due to the fierce determination, self-confidence, and optimism of young people to change the world. And they did change the world. And the underlining theme of this talk is going to be, no matter our age, we can change the world as well. So, first, to set the record straight, I was not in the building during the sit-in. I was out of the country. But 2 years after the occupation, I got a job at Deaf Services at the Center for Independent Living. So CIL is a self-help and advocacy center founded by folks with disabilities in Berkeley. And as fate would have it, I would become friends and comrades with many of the former occupiers as an attendant, assisting people with disabilities with basic daily activities. Come on. Get comfortable, you guys. Come on in. Perfect timing. We're getting to the meat of it. And there's some handouts and some snacks. Get yourself comfortable and welcome. So I would become, as I was saying, I was becoming friends and comrades with many of the former occupiers, and I was working as an attendant and assisting people with disabilities with their daily living, such as dressing and bathing and eating. Because I was around so much during the day, a lot of the people from the sit-in swear that I was in the building with them. Are you sure you weren't there? I'm almost positive I shared a joint with you. But contrary to what people might say, I stand here to tell you I was not physically in the building, but I sure was there in spirit. So what is this animal, the 504? This says, no otherwise qualified handicapped individual in the United States should solely by reason of his handicap, their wording, be excluded in the participation, be denied the benefits of, or be subject to discrimination under any program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. So in a nutshell, what that means is that no one should be excluded from any program or any service that receives federal funds. In her oral history, a woman named Mary Lou Breslin, a leader of the 504 sit-in, an occupation, made the point, Section 504's language was modeled on the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Maybe it's hard to see, but it was inserted into the Rehabilitation Act of this 1973, and it didn't make a lot of logical sense because it should have been its own statute. It should have been based on freedom and justice. But she noted that the rehabilitation statute was a really quick and dirty vehicle to advance human and civil rights. And it is on your handout if you want to have a little look. So I asked Mary Lou, but how did the 504 language that really does read almost verbatim to the civil rights language end up in the Rehab Act? And if you can see, they're almost exactly the same. And she said the original idea for the statute was conceived by a small group of congressional aides who understood that disability discrimination was truly a problem. And without civil rights, people would not be able to participate fully in society. So this little law here was passed by Congress and was signed into law by Republican President Richard Nixon. Sounds good, right? Signed into law. Not quite. Because once a law gets passed, it has absolutely no authority. It has no teeth until the regulations are created. Regulations have to be issued to define, like, who is a disabled person and what does otherwise qualified mean and what constituted discrimination. So let's just take an example of two bus companies. This is before the regulations were passed. One bus pulls up. A driver opens the door. There is no power lift for the wheelchair. A person cannot get on the bus. The judge rules, the bus stopped. They opened the door. The person didn't get on, so they're not discriminating, and they are in compliance. Now let's take another bus company. Bus pulls up. Driver opens the door. There's no lift. The person can't get on the bus. The judge rules that this bus company is not in compliance, and therefore the company's actions are ruled as discriminatory. So you can see, wrong, the first. So although Nixon signed the law, he then vetoed the regulations twice, in part because the regulations contained far-reaching civil rights language, and in part it would cost the government money. And I can't believe I'm going to quote Dick, but Dick says, it would be a spending spree, a massive assault on the pocketbooks of men and women of this country. Throwing money at problems doesn't solve anything. So, if you were thinking that maybe the Democrats are a little bit more caring and compassionate, let me tell you about Democrat Jimmy Carter. When he was running for president, Carter promised the disability rights organizations that he would sign the 504 regulations, thereby allowing the law to take its full force. And this is what he said. No administration that really cared about disabled people would spend 3 years trying to avoid enforcing Section 504. No compassionate administration would force disabled consumers to take it to court before it would be enforced into law. After Carter's election, word leaked out. His administration was drastically watering down the regulations, so 504 would be just a little bit more than a separate but equal law. Judy Heumann, one of the 504 sit-in leaders of the occupation, made the analogy of Brown versus the Board of Education and the lack of equity for disabled children. And she said, and this is a quote, whether or not there was a Section 504, there was a Brown versus Board of Education. The harassment, the lack of equity that has been provided for disabled individuals and that is now even being discussed by the administration is so intolerable that I can't quite put it into words. I can tell you that every time you raise the issue of separate but equal, the outrage of disabled individuals across this country is going to continue. There will be more takeovers of buildings until finally, maybe, you begin to understand our position. We will no longer allow the government to oppress disabled individuals. We want the law enforced. We want no more segregation. We will accept no more discussion of segregation. And this is the part I kind of love, if you know Judy Heumann at all. This is when she stopped and she looked at one of the bureaucrats and said, you know, I'd appreciate it if you would stop shaking your head in agreement when I don't think you understand what I'm talking about. And this admonishment from Judy would cause even the most stoic bureaucrat to shudder. I know I would. So, long delays by President Carter's point person, his name was Joseph Califano, Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, he refused to sign off on the regulations, and he kept talking about separate and equal. This just infuriated mainstream disabled service organizations and people with disabilities. Organizing and lobbying increased with a campaign of pass 504 unchanged and sign or resign. Now, understand, this is 1977. The society did not look at people with disabilities as an oppressed minority or a group even deserving of civil rights. People with disabilities were objects of charity, objects of pity, seen as a group of people who were very weak and who could not do things for themselves. Disabled rights was not part of public consciousness at all. Kitty Cohn, a longtime activist and a member of the Socialist Worker Party and a 504 organizer, would say that until the 504 sit-in, the people with disabilities themselves didn't think of the issues faced in their daily lives were the product of pressure of prejudice or discrimination. Kitty would say that the reason she couldn't attend a university that was inaccessible was because she couldn't walk. It was her own personal problem, not a societal problem. The thought of mass action demanding a change in society rather than changing oneself in itself was literally a revolutionary idea. So in a nutshell, this medical model focuses on finding a cure and managing an illness or disability, whereas people with disabilities weren't expecting a cure. Instead, they were demanding access. Now remember, discrimination and the exclusion of people with disabilities existed in every single aspect of life, from education, employment, housing, transportation, medical care, getting into a public building. So maybe, hopefully, y'all are starting to get a feel for what the challenges were for the organizers and activists who had come, who had to overcome in building for this movement. So is today, as it was in 1977, the answer to inaccessibility and oppression is mass action to build a movement, make demands, and change society, not change the individual. So after waiting 4+ years, 1973 to 1977, for the government to sign these regulations, the American Coalition of Citizens with Disabilities, called ACCD, issued an ultimatum in March 1977, and they threatened, if the regulations are not written to ACCD standards and signed by April 4th, there will be nationwide political actions. The call became, not in May, signed today. So, in Berkeley, California, the Emergency Coalition of 504 held huge meetings at the Center for Independent Living. It was a one-person, one-vote coalition. There were no dues, there were no official membership. Kitty Cohn and other socialists felt that the broader that you build something, the better chance that you have for success. A broad umbrella meant collaborating extensively with advocates from other community groups outside the disability movement. It also did help to have a group of paralegals who were, they were a group of folks, a rainbow of disabilities, including folks who use wheelchairs, some folks were deaf, some were blind, and others who really understood the importance of the 504 regulations. They found creative and effective ways to communicate with one another. The activists held teach-ins and trained one another on the ramifications and the dangers of watered-down regulations. Their motto was to learn the issues, collaborate, and organize. Each paralegal had their role in helping prepare for these April demonstrations, from medical, press, outreach, and fundraising. So, building for this demonstration of people with disabilities was difficult and it was a huge challenge. For example, in New York in 1977 did not have public accessible public transportation. It meant getting information out to people and reaching far and wide, whether it was in Braille, large print, or TTYs, telephone typewriters for the deaf. This was a time before scanners, you guys, a time before cell phones and computers. So outreach flyers meant making leaflets and taking the little plastic letters, cutting them out, and cranking out those mimeograph machine to make copies, or hand making posters like these. But nonetheless, it was built far and wide. The call was put out to everyone, everywhere, everyone. And in the April-May 1977 issue of the Black Panther Party newspaper, it really put out quite a compelling call, and it went like this, I quote, "To my brothers and sisters that are black and that are handicapped, get out there. We need you. Come here. We need you. Wherever you are, we need you. Get out of your bed. Get into your wheelchair. Get out of your crutches and into your canes. If you can't walk, call somebody. Talk to somebody over the telephone. If you can't talk, write. If you can't write, use sign language. Any method of communication. That is all. It is open. We need to show the government that we have more force than they can ever deal with." So, what we also learned was the very important tactic, end quote. We learned from a very important tactic of the civil rights movement of the 1960s was the sit-in. The more left-wing disabled activists saw the sit-in as a brilliant strategy to borrow from. Activists decided that if regulations were not signed unchanged, they would occupy the very department that was responsible for signing 504 regulations, which was the Health, Education, and Welfare Department, HEW. At organizational meetings all over the country, militant organizers began building the demonstration as a sit-in. But really, it was kind of on the QT, the quiet talk, in secret, because they didn't want to alert the law enforcement who might, in turn, bar the demonstrations and bar people from entering the HEW buildings. So the stereotype that people with disabilities are weak and therefore incapable of a strong political action, let alone a radical takeover of a federal building, actually kind of worked in the favor of the 504 organizers. One by one, the word spread. The sit-in was in the works. Bring a sleeping bag. So let me ask you, do you think the 504 regulations were signed by April 4th deadline?
No.
Correct. No. So, in San Francisco, on May 5th, 1977, people from all over the Bay Area, people with disabilities, attendants, interpreters, and supporters rallied. Sign language interpreter Lynette Taylor, a recent transplant from Kentucky and 18 years old, said, "I got a phone call that said, cover a demonstration as an interpreter for a couple of hours. Those 2 hours turned into an entire month." So at one point during the demonstration, Judy Heumann gave this predetermined signal that said something like this, "Come on, let's go. Let's see why they haven't signed the 5-0 regulations. Come on, everyone, let's go." But remember, at this point, there still had been no public mention of a sit-in. So on the face of it, Judy was really just saying, "Come on, let's go get some answers," when in fact, really, this was the call, "Let's occupy." So up to the fourth floor, the protesters went. The meeting room was filled, packed with as many people that could be packed into a room, and including the press. The HEW officials treated the demonstrators with such condescension, they actually gave them cookies and punch, as though they were on some kind of a field trip, instead of people fighting for their lives and fighting for their civil rights. Judy, acting as a spokesperson, asked the director, "Hey, what's happening with the regulations? We're not leaving until Section 4 regulations are signed." The director had absolutely no idea what 504 was, but the demonstrator showed absolutely no sympathy. So, on Monday, April 5th, lacking an answer, the San Francisco HEW was officially occupied. Yes! So, let's look at day one. Demonstrators from all over the country. I'm gonna pop over here.
Lori, take the...
take the people. So, starting over here, I just love the looks of that, the long of it, almost a month occupation. So in day one, the demonstrators all over the country in San Francisco occupied the HEW building. We read the news, we watch the TV coverage. In the beginning, they said, "It's an army of crippled and deaf and dumb people who went into the federal building." So they decided, we're going to have to obviously educate this press. Those terms, crippled, deaf, and dumb, were so offensive. Also, Cesar Chavez, president of the Farm Workers Union, sent a letter of support. On day two, in Washington, D.C., the occupiers have to leave the HEW building because D.C. created such intolerable conditions for the protesters. And the other protests fizzle out without support, so now all eyes are on San Francisco. Day three. HEW turns off the hot water. Phone lines are reduced to two pay phones. Incoming calls are limited. HEW prohibits occupiers from leaving the building and re-entering, which made it difficult for people to get their medications and treatments for them to stay. Day four, LA protest is over. In San Francisco, local businesses and nonprofits donate food. In San Francisco, eight people start a hunger strike. The Black Panther sends a letter of support. A group of protesters celebrate the last day of Passover inside the fourth floor elevator. We're going to skip to day six. Okay. Easter service held along with the egg hunt for the children, the HEW court, and the payphones inside the buildings are jammed. So on day seven, the HEW, supporters gave the HEW workers some daffodils, and local farmers provided medication. So let's see, we're going to jump to day 10. So there we are, day 10. If I find my page, we will. Daily food deliveries start to come from the Black Panthers for the duration of the entire sit-in. Clyde Memorial Church and others sustain the sit-in. Wheelchair races ensue in the hallways to let off steam. We're going to skip day 11, day 13. It's getting pretty difficult inside there now. There's lice, crabs, bed sores, food keeps coming in, and there's plans made to go to Washington, D.C. On day 14, finally, Mayor Moscone gets more mobile showers and towels brought in, and the HEW officials pull back and say, nope, nope, we're not running a hotel here. But the White House overrules out of their compassion, and the showers are installed. We're going to skip to look at what's closer happening on the ground in San Francisco during this nearly one-month-long occupation. The day-to-day experience of nearly a month-long sit-in would be grueling for any group. As one occupier said, the discomfort and anxiety was the order of the day-to-day of our existence. Another said that for the first couple of nights, he slept in his wheelchair because it meant less transferring in and out and less having to ask folks for assistance. Others talked about not having urinary catheters or backup ventilators and other very necessary medical equipment. And I have to say, it is true that demonstrators did risk their lives literally to stay in the building for the fight of their lives. So let's look at why activists in San Francisco were able to occupy a federal building with such success. So this is a part that I absolutely love, because some of the key leaders who had emerged from the disability movements got their training in the civil rights movement, civil rights and the women movement. One leader in particular, Kitty Cohn, would say that she honed her logistical and strategical experience as well as her organizational skills from her work in the Socialist Worker Party. And as a socialist, she found it necessary to work with people in all parts of life and to get issue support from everyone. And that really paid off, as we never thought possible before. They got support from the Teamsters, SEIU, the Black Panther Party, Glide Memorial Church, the Gay Men's Butterfly Brigade, the International Association of Machinists, and the Swords to Plowshare. Kitty, as a socialist, had an organizer's mind, an uncanny ability to see the big picture as well as the details. She could simultaneously juggle an immense amount of responsibilities, ensuring occupiers got bathed and fed, ensuring that they kept the press's attentions. They had public hearings. They worked with people's different agendas and still stayed focused on this particular event. And the oral histories of many disabled folks who were interviewed said that Kitty Cohn's enormous amount of logistical and strategic experience came from her being an out socialist. So everyone, every single occupier, supporter, served on a committee of their own choosing. Everything from attending care, security, a morale committee, music, making copies, creating art, a medical, a hygiene need, food, childcare, cleanup, fundraising, clothes. It goes on and on, including entertainment, press, and outreach. So this part is interesting as socialist, I believe, that each committee had a representative on a larger steering committee. And Kitty pointed out that in a true democracy, everyone needs to be involved in decision making. Leadership bodies need to represent different points of views. These divergent points of views need to be talked about so other alternatives can be discussed and debated. The committees were very fluid, effective, and efficient. Once the occupiers were established in the buildings, you can imagine there were tactical decisions that were being made every single hour. Most of the tactical decisions had to do with the outside forces, which were the federal marshals. The marshals' job was to try to engineer a way to get the demonstrators out of the building with the audience getting even more bad publicity by taking people out on stretchers. So as Kitty said, of course the people from the federal government wanted us out. We weren't going to leave. That was it. We stayed. The feds would attempt to create anxiety and fear among the occupiers, fake bomb threats, intimidating police dogs, threats that the police and fire were going to come and get them out at 4 in the morning. They insisted that the occupiers stop opening people's offices in search of a place to sleep. The occupiers formed a security meeting. And thank you. And I hope this should be like 12 minutes, guys. Fingers crossed. The occupiers formed a security committee and met daily with marshals. The security committee did an excellent job of not only neutralizing the guards, but they actually befriended them as well. And this becomes very important later on. The people did not have freedom to come and go. People were locked in. If they left, they couldn't return. The lack of fresh air really was quite stifling. Initially, the lack of, remember, it was like 14 days, no soap, no access to bathing possibilities, and accessible bathroom made day-to-day living really quite difficult. People got lice in the bed bugs and infections and strep throat. Others were just exhausted from, just feverish with exhaustion. One of the occupiers told me that there was actually a mini crisis around feminine and hygiene products. It's a medical fact. As folks know, when a group of women get together for a period of time, so are their menstrual cycles together. So people adapted to this nearly one month long occupation in a variety of ways. There was card playing. There was a lot of singing. There were freedom songs such as "This Little Light of Mine," "Oh Freedom," and "We Shall Overcome." There was a couple of nice voices, but according to one occupier, you know, when we sang Amazing Grace, we kind of sounded like cats screeching. But the singing kept up our morale and reminded us that we were a civil rights movement. We were press animals too. Whenever the press showed up, no matter how exhausted we were, no matter what we were doing, we'd get up and start singing our hearts out with inspirational freedom songs from our brothers and sisters in the past. Now, this is the 70s, and drugs flowed freely. There's a whole lot of carnal knowledge being shared. One of the occupiers decided to capitalize on the lack of space and set up a little sex tent. And they actually charged $1 for the occupiers to rent some privacy. And you know what? It was just a little sheet hung over a rope. And there was such an outcry, that was such a ripoff, that he had to lower a sign on one of those little Charlie Brown cartoons where Lucy keeps lowering the price for her psychiatric help, 47 cents, 5 cents. So as those loosey-goosey as it kind of sounded, the occupiers were really quite disciplined. They were directing their own destiny. They had daily teach-ins about what their next steps were going to be. And for the most part, the demonstrators and supporters did agree with the 5-word regulations. But there was really one very important internal argument, and that had to do with whether substance use disorder and alcoholism should it be covered in 504. Part of the organizing meant educating and debating the issue, and ultimately there was a consensus, yes, to include these disabilities. There was also sign language classes where everyone from quadriplegics to blind people participated. And remember when the phone lines were cut, sign language proved invaluable to communicate with supporters outside from the fourth floor. They would communicate with what they needed, with their attendant care needs, their medicine, whatever they needed. And because there was such a diversity of individuals, from people who had been institutionalized, from parents of disabled children who had never even met another disabled adult, there was a lot of socializing and getting to know each other and their challenges. So after the occupation, after the protests and occupation around the country collapsed, San Francisco had to expand their fight. So we're going to skip over here to day 12. I'm well trained. I have it. Day 12. So here we are. We're going back and forth a bit. So a delegation of 25 people are voted to go to Washington, D.C. On day 15, 25 people fly to Washington, D.C. There's 18 disabled folks, 7 attendants, and a couple of interpreters. Because there was no accessible buses, the machinists rent a windowless cargo van, a cargo truck. There's no tie-downs for wheelchairs. This mode of transportation became known as the Machinist's Limousine. And the first harrowing ride was to Califano, the secretary house, for a candlelight vigil that went all the way through the night until dawn. And then back in San Francisco, they still held down the fort with 75 demonstrators. On day 18, armed police blocked the entrance to the National Washington Museum HEW building as the San Francisco delegation tries to meet with Califano. Let's see. On day 22, we're getting there. Day 22, 100 protesters remain in the building in San Francisco. Bay Area supporters continue demonstrating outside. The Black Panther parties continue bringing food. The San Francisco delegation on day 23, they have a demonstration right outside his event. And on day 24, without any fanfare whatsoever, Califano finally signed Section 504. So, on this day, in San Francisco, the demonstrators, they stay in the building. They're not going to leave till everybody gets back from Washington. Margaret Dusty Irvine ends her 21-day-old hunger strike. On day 25, the protesters think the signing of the regulations is maybe not true. Maybe it's a trick, and they wait for verification. The protesters clean up the building, and they all spend one more night in the building. And on day 26, the occupiers leave the building together. There's cheers from the HEW employees and federal marshals, and they join a large public rally and toast the victory with champagne. So I'm going to sum up with just a few more things here, and that is, what can we learn from the 504 occupation, from this exciting piece of history from below? That ordinary people can change the world. Changing the world requires an organization that is democratic, a bottom-up organization. Changing the world also requires radical ideas and bold strategies. When we limit ourselves to only lobbying the politicians retain the power and we're ignored until we go away. Now, I've been to a lot of workshops on disability, and oftentimes some of the conversation becomes a place and time where we share our living nightmare for seeking accommodation, for disability benefits, and for quality of issues. The system's set up to disempower us. It's disgusting. It's frustrating. And Section 504 and the ADA disabilities were major life-changing reforms, whereas the benefits such as SSI, SSDI, FMLA, Voc Rehab, they still base their model of disability where the physician is the central decider of what you get and what you don't get. So while this is very important, the 504 Rehab Act, it's huge, we're really only going to succeed not at one disability claim or lawsuit at a time. It's going to be collectively directing our anger, our frustration and determination, creativity, and our power into a new movement where we can wrest concessions from this very heartless system and build a movement that helps achieve a world where it takes priority, where people take priority over benefits, to have true democracy, and not socialism. However, if you are involved in your own personal hell, SSI, SSDI, this is on your handout. I highly recommend you to download it. I'll get you a copy. It's called Documenting Disability. Give it to your physician. Your physician follows this. I can almost guarantee you'll get it in your first time around, not your second, not your third, and not a denial. So my final summation. I want to finish this part with a quote from Kitty Cohn, and it is also referenced in your handout. Love that handout, can you tell? It goes. Did the disabled people in the HEW building show strength beyond your wildest dreams? Did the disabled people in the HEW building show strength beyond your wildest imagination? And did we show courage? And did we show commitment? And did we show power? We did. We did. We showed strength, courage, power, and commitment that in the face of government ignorance and inhumanity and deceit and closed doors, we've persisted along with all of our beautiful supporters, and we won the victory. By God, no one gave us anything. We did it with the active support of thousands of people. There's no way to thank everybody, but I want to thank the Panthers, the Machinist Union, our gay brothers and sisters, everybody. To all of you who have fought with us in so many ways, thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.